FDF Awards. One of the most prestigious nights in the food and drink calendar is online 3rd of February. For details of this and other FDF events, including our online convention, visit our website, fdf.org.uk. FDF, passionate about food and drink.
I'll be your chair for this afternoon section of our conference, Scotland and Wales Key Issues Focus. Over the next 1.5 hours, we will explore developments in the political landscape, Brexit and COVID-19 recovery plans, and evolutions in diet, health, and environmental policy in both nations. I'm delighted that we have a stellar lineup for you with the details on the website, as it will bring a unique insight in between us, and with help from the questions from the floor, we hope to explore all these issues and have a really engaging debate. Firstly, in terms of the political landscape, we'll be joined by Neris Evans from Derren, whose experience in terms of members of the Senate will be invaluable, and David Thompson from our very own FDF Scotland. In the second section, when we move to talk about recovery plans, I'll be joined by Andy Richardson to explore those plans from Wales, who will also be in discussion with David. And at that point, I think we'll all have earned a 3-minute break, so there'll be a small break, small comfort break. And for finale, we bring out the stars of the show in Kat Hay and Julie Byers, both from FDF in Scotland and in Wales, who will explore the policy developments in diet, health and the environment. However, before we delve into the politics in the first stage, I really want to encourage you to raise questions. On the right-hand side, there's a grey questions box. Please input your questions there. Or if it's easier, you'll see a little question mark that you can use as the chat function. And if you put them in the chat function, we'll pick them up there. Because ideally, we'd like to engage the questions and we'd like to actually have the questions engaged as we go along. So as we move into the first one, I'd like to welcome Neris and David initially for the first discussion. I'd like to discuss really the standout political developments over recent months and how this changed in the political landscape in both nations. I mean, turning to Neris first, one thing I noticed, Neris, I think it was halfway through the year, was when the announcement was made that because situations potentially impact the health of the people of Wales, then those matters were effectively a matter for Welsh ministers. So clearly the dynamics changed in terms of the Welsh Government. I mean, how do you think that's changed and what do you think that's impacted in policy of Welsh Government?
Well, pnawn da, Pete, and thanks for the invitation to be here this afternoon. Yes, I think lots of people have woken up to the fact that we have devolution across the UK this year, keeping us busy and on our toes. And I think the key thing is the fact that health regulations and legislation and regulations on protecting the health of the people of Wales have been devolved to the Welsh Government. And I think that's been quite a shock to people in terms of the powers that we have here in Wales, likewise in Scotland and Northern Ireland too. So the thing to remember is obviously we've got a different party in government here in Wales. We have a Labour government, a Labour minority government, with the support of one Lib Dem, one independent MS, member of the Senate, to make it a majority government here. Left of centre government, a different approach to policy making, and then different policy outcomes. So we've seen the Welsh government here champion fair work, social partnership principles in terms of developing policy, and that's been embedded throughout their policy making and policy procedures during COVID. So the social partnership model, the government did want to put that on a legal footing, but I've had to pause on that because of COVID and not enough timetable in the Senedd to get that legislation through. But they've embedded the principles of decisions being taken to the social partnerships, the social council, where you have employers and employees being part of that decision making. And we saw that quite early on in some of the policy differential we've seen here in Wales. So although these powers have been devolved to the four nations of the UK, or three and Westminster, and there has been a desire to work collectively and on a four nation approach, there is no doubt that the Welsh Government are taking decisions in the best interest on the best information and evidence in terms of the people of Wales, and we have seen differences. So if you remember early on, there was an issue in terms of business rates, where businesses in England have business rate relief. The Welsh Government took a different stand and put a cap on that. So no properties with over 500,000 rateable value had business rate relief. And that money was redirected to small and medium enterprises here in Wales. Caused outrage from the 50 premises that couldn't get the rate relief. very interesting to see Tesco today giving back the funds on business rate relief, and they were the very vocal campaigners and lodged a big campaign against the Welsh Government back in April on that. So a very important emphasis there that the Welsh Government were there looking at in terms of how to support the economy and medium and micro businesses. We also saw really early on the fact that Welsh Government embedded in legislation the 2 metre distancing in the workplace. Not sure where my webcam's gone, but if you can hear me. The 2 metre physical distancing in the workplace, that was embedded in legislation in Wales and it hasn't been embedded elsewhere. That was in direct response from complaints by unions and workers across Wales that they felt that they were being put under undue pressure to work in circumstances that they weren't, their health and safety weren't being respected. So we've seen different approaches here. ERF, the Economic Resilience Fund, obviously plugging some of those gaps filled by Westminster government support, and lots of food and drink manufacturers obviously being benefited from that. So, and obviously we've seen a different approach in terms of lockdown restrictions. We've had a fire break, and now obviously the changes coming into place on Friday and some more support into the hospitality sector and the supply chains. So a different approach, although trying to work on a four nations, but taking the evidence based here in terms of public health measures by the Welsh Government.
So that's quite a picture to say. I'll give you a breath and probably turn to David now, if that's okay. I mean, obviously the independence debate, David, is at a different level in Scotland, clearly. And I just wondered whether what's happened over the recent experience has intensified that independence debate. And actually the way that the Scottish Government has acted is what you would have expected, or taking their independence agenda even further?
Well, I think it's important, Pete, to remember that even before devolution, so even before 1999, Scotland always had different institutions. So we've always had different policy around education. We've always had different policy around the courts. We've always had different policy around agricultural support and all those kind of things. So there's always been a different approach in Scotland. I think what COVID has seen, and many of the things that Neris has set out, happened in a different way in Scotland. So we actually had to fight behind the scenes. So FDF Scotland and a lot of our partners were fighting behind the scenes to support the designation of food and drink as a critical sector, because that wasn't definite at the start. And we had to fight to make sure there were school places available and to fight to make sure that food and drink businesses could be open. That's continued all the way through. Some of the things about rateable value, there was a different set of circumstances in Scotland where actually they put the cap at much lower and didn't allow people to who had multiple premises to get the rateable value initially. As we go forward, we've got a different tier system. We've got 5 tiers in Scotland. We didn't have a full lockdown like what happened in England in the last month or so, but we do have most of Scotland in tiers 3 and 4, which are our highest tiers. So all of that just kind of shows that there are huge differences in different parts of the UK. I think the question about independence is really interesting, because certainly Nicola Sturgeon has become much more ubiquitous in people's houses, because she leads a daily briefing every day and people are waiting to see what she has to say. And I think what is really interesting, because the kind of figures of infections and figures of death are broadly comparable all across the UK, and certainly between England and Scotland. But it appears that the First Minister gets more credibility because she's more straight talking. She is more empathetic and appears to be more in touch with people. So certainly the view of the people of Scotland is that, and this is, you know, rolled out in lots and lots of different polls, is that she has handled the crisis much better than the Westminster government. So if anything has happened around people's perception of independence here, it's really in about that personal credibility of the leader, I think.
Okay, that's interesting. So to move our debate along then, in terms of one thing that's in common between Scotland and Wales is the fact we've both got elections next year on the same date, 6th of May 2021. In terms of how the election will shape up between now and May, and what sort of policy priorities, what do you expect to see as the outcome? I suppose I'd go back to Neris and say, from a Welsh perspective, Neris, what does your crystal ball tell you?
I'm not Mystic Meg, but and the big caveat that everything could change. We're in a pandemic. You know, what we're talking about today could be completely different in 6 months' time, 5 months' time. So bear that in mind. Obviously, in terms of the vaccine, in terms of the end of transition phase for Brexit and all the rest of it. But as things stand at the moment, so the polls in Wales have been fascinating, actually. So, you know, in terms of the context of this, we haven't had a majority government in Wales since the advent of devolution in 99. We've had a minority government and supply and confidence deals. We've had formal and informal coalitions. We've had formal and informal deals on budgets and legislation. All the polls indicate we're not going to have a majority government after May. So what does this mean for your sector and kind of the wider policy development? Well, you know, it is fascinating that we are going to have to see parties work together, regardless of what they say ahead of the election. And I've been there myself saying, you know, won't work with anybody, but actually, you know, forming a coalition. And it's normal across the world. So I think we've got over that. So the recent polling, so we saw a poll just after the first lockdown. Historic, you know, the first poll ever to see the Tories topping the poll in Wales in terms of the popular vote and also in terms of number of seats projected to win next in May. Now, there was slightly, you know, backing the flag type of thing, you know, a couple of weeks into lockdown, you know, that sense of let's back the government and see, you know, Boris and his announcements. I think things have shifted in the polls since then. As David was saying, in Scotland, opinion polls here and kind of the polling does suggest that people generally support what the Welsh Government are doing. Not sure how that's reflected this week. I think the decision in terms of banning alcohol after 6 o'clock on Friday, that potentially, you know, just looking at social media, I think that hasn't gone down as well as the other previous decisions. So we'll see how, if that shifts in terms of that. So that poll, you know, the Tories on a historic high back in April. So we've seen a few since and it's shifted and it's gone back and it's quite phenomenal. The last poll a couple of weeks back saw Labour still topping the poll on, I think, 26 or 28 seats even, which is remarkable considering they've been in power since 99. But the big picture stuff is, you know, no one party will have a majority. The opposition would be looking at ways of getting Labour out and working together. That might sound bonkers to people outside of Wales, but it did happen in 2007 when I was a member of the Senate. There was an alternative to the Labour government, a programme of government even developed between Plaid Cymru, the Tories and the Lib Dems. It all fell over. I won't get into the detail of that now, but you know, that was on the agenda. And then finally the Plaid Labour coalition got off the ground. So the opposition will be looking at ways of working together to get Labour out and proving, as they've done in Scotland, as soon as they're out once, not very good at opposition and, you know, seeing what's happened there. But also, we've got a different scenario next year compared to 2007. You've got the Tories in government in Westminster now and, you know, again, seeing how the popular opinion is of how Boris is dealing with the COVID situation. So Plaid as kingmakers, you know, Labour and the Tories might need to work together on different budget deals or legislation. If the nurses need to be paid next week, and we've seen it, you know, elsewhere in local government where they have to rely on each other, but that would not be natural territory. You know, Plaid would be kingmakers. Labour would be looking at Plaid to, you know, for a formal informal deal and obviously the Tories as well. So everything's to play for there. Still, you know, looking at the polling, we would say minority Labour or a Labour Plaid formal informal coalition are the most likely outcomes. But the last poll a couple of weeks back was really interesting because we've got seven UKIP members elected into, you know, people of Wales, Democratic elected them, of course, in 2007. They all fell out with each other within a week. And some were independent, some were abolished the Assembly Party, some are just random mix of people, you know, right-leaning politicians. So the latest poll, in the last election, did affect the opposition's ability to come together and form an alternative government. You've got seven UKIP members there, and there's no numbers there because nobody would work with them. So the last poll a couple of weeks back in Wales showed that we would get four abolish the Assembly candidates elected, That's great news for the Labour Party because that means the numbers don't stack up for an alternative. So we have to see where that goes in terms of polling, and there's a whole load of issues with that. So I think in terms of looking at next year, it's all to play for. I think we need to be prepared for parties working together. So we'll be looking at their manifestos and how they develop some of those ideas. And so it's important to look at the three main parties here and not just presume that it's just the Labour Party because they've been since 99.
Okay, crikey. So there's a bit going on then for sure. And it's a fluid situation and it's a developing situation. David, if I go to Scotland, obviously it's a slightly different scenario up there, but what's the landscape in terms of the politics up there for the next election, do you think?
Well, I think on the politics side, Pete, Wales, actually, we have tended towards either coalition governments or coalitions in power. The only time that we've only done it once when there's been one party out with a coalition that's been in power, and that's not now. The current supply and confidence agreement that the Scottish National Party have with the Greens is what takes them over the magic number of MSPs required. I remember I used to be a civil servant working in the Scottish Government, and I remember having to explain to UK government colleagues how to work in a coalition not that long ago when they had the Tory and Lib Dem coalition. They were confused about how one could do that. In terms of the broad picture, in 2015 we had the resurgence of the Tories in Scotland under Ruth Davidson, now Baroness Davidson, TV star, that was a very much them and us kind of issue. So it was either a pro-independence party, which is either the SNP or the Greens in Scotland, or the Tories as the most effective and most media savvy of the remaining parties. Labour, which had a Scottish heartland, is in deep and probably terminal decline at the moment. To be credible, it needs to divest itself from the machinations of UK Labour. The Greens are very much a pro-independence party. They appeal more to young people. And so on. But the SNP, if you remember, after 2014, had a massive increase in membership until it became actually the biggest political party in the UK in terms of membership. And that was really around the failure of the independence vote. So the boost in membership came really after the end of the independence vote, with a generation of people activated to actually say, well, next time we want the result to be different. And actually, the SNP are now having to deal internally with the consequences of that. So we had the SNP conference this weekend, just passed. Nicola Sturgeon there set out, that she wanted to see another independence referendum for Scotland in the early part of the next Scottish Parliament. Obviously, Boris Johnson has already said no. So there's a rush between the mandate that's given by the electorate in Scotland towards the Scottish Parliament versus the mandate that's given by the electorate across the UK to the UK Parliament. And how that pans out, nobody knows. And within the party, Sturgeon, I think, has probably consolidated their power a bit over the weekend. But there are still people, including Joanna Cherry, who was the person, if you remember, who took the court case around the UK government and Brexit and won, who has a bit of cachet as well. So when we're looking at the vote, you can't really see past an SNP or an SNP and Green alliance moving into the next stage, and a pro-independence alliance moving into the next stage. And if I was a betting man, that's what I'd be putting my money on.
Okay, thank you. You're both passionate about the topic, so we're running over time already, so I'm just going to have to ask you. But what I really do want to ask you is, obviously, we're the Food and Drink Federation, and what really excites me is, what does this mean for what type of policies do you think the food sector are going to see? If I could maybe start with you, Neris and Wales, you did mention earlier on about the social partnerships. So are there any other sort of specific aspects that you think will be significant and our members in Wales should know about them?
Well, in terms of the context that we're operating in, obviously we need to look at COVID and the fallout of that. So I'd imagine, you know, the role, as David said, about getting food and drink manufacturers as key workers, that, you know, is a devolved responsibility, as is the role of the vaccine. So those discussions between now and the election, before that, about, you know, how do we make sure that your members and food and drink manufacturers are at top of the list in terms of key workers for that vaccine rollout and the knock-on consequences for that in terms of production. You know, internal markets bill, that's imminent. And we historically saw three Senate committees last week published reports saying that it would be detrimental to devolution, detrimental to the Senedd, the Welsh Government, and citing food and drink and animal welfare as one of the things that could be undermined in Wales if that was passed. So the three committees are advising the Senedd to not give their consent. The UK government can still pass it without that. So that's one to watch. So things like, you know, if the Welsh government wanted to introduce specific standards in Wales, they could be totally undermined and overruled by standards in England. So it's the English market that dominates. And obviously, who wins the election in terms of their manifesto developments? I know you've got another session now in terms of the detail there. So it would be crucial to look at, you know, how the parties are developing their manifestos. What are the key asks? You know, and just a note to note, you know, that some policy developments are developed in Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, and then do get traction across the UK. You know, we were one of the parties, Plaid Cymru, first to talk about sugar tax in their manifesto, in their policy conference 15 years ago, I think, and now that's kind of mainstream, obviously happened. They're now talking about taxing unhealthy foods. How do you define that? Stuff on the circular economy, stuff, all these types of policies that I know you're going to talk about in the next session. So lots to think about, but the context is really important between now and the next election as well.
Oh, that's terrific. Thank you. And over to you, David. Same question in terms of our sector. What do you see being really important in Scotland?
Yeah, like Nara said, the internal market bill is something that's had an effect. So really, the context of that is how post-Brexit law works for the food industry. So that's a really critical issue and one that's causing a lot of heat amongst the four parliaments. In terms of building to the next, to the election, you know, it's unsurprisingly, the obvious bits, actually, it's the health debate. So FTF Scotland had a great win by getting the Scottish Government to shelve the promotions regulation that they were going to bring in. We won that argument on economics. So the impact on small and medium-sized enterprises in Scotland would have been detrimental to them. That's going to come back. It's already been promised it's come back, and every single party is going to support something like it. So the key question there is, how do we manage you know, the business's relationship with the Scottish Government as that happens. And in fact, it's much more likely, based on our discussions with them, that there's going to be a more holistic and wider ranging approach to the legislation that brings that in. And then the second element, and this is really key, because I've said before, the SNP will probably have to rely on the Greens as their partners. So the key element is around the environment. So we've already had a climate emergency declared. We've had several bits of climate legislation delayed because of COVID. And really, the next 4 years will be the test to see how the Scottish Government plans to introduce legislation to meet its targets, which are ahead of the UK or international targets quite often in a lot of these different areas.
Okay, well, thank you. That's terrific. Really interesting. So what I'm going to do now is probably move on to our next topic. Neris, we will hear from you again later on. Thank you very much for that. David, you hang fire. And I'm just going to ask Andy Richardson to join us. Thanks, Andy. Okay. Thank you for joining. Welcome, everyone, Andy Richardson. Basically, we're moving on to the Brexit and the recovery approaches and the recovery plans. I mean, both Scottish and Welsh governments are announcing recovery plans over the last week. I'd be interested to start with some background on how the plans have been put together and the aims and the ambitions of each government. Andy, obviously, from your position in the board, you've got a real view of what the governments are trying to achieve and what opportunities and challenges they're trying to overcome.
Sure. So, afternoon, everybody. So in terms of what we've been doing in Wales, effectively, it's working in partnership between industry and the government. So it's been a strong partnership. And several months ago, I lose track of what exactly it was, but several months ago, we started working on our recovery plan. And we've come up with a recovery plan, this 11-point recovery plan. You asked about opportunities and challenges. Well, I would say it's a mixture. Of course, we don't doubt that this coronavirus under the current environment of Brexit is a real challenge for many businesses. We know that while some are thriving, some are desperately suffering, particularly those associated with hospitality. So what we've done is the opportunities focus around a changing market. Effectively, it's market intelligence. You know, we need to be really much better about accessing the latest market intelligence. What's changing? What are the insights, not just in the UK, not just in Wales, but also globally? And we need to be really good at reacting to those as an industry. Another example, Pete, might be online. We all know online is taking off. Well, why shouldn't Wales be part of that? And why shouldn't we be at the front end of that? I actually think we've got a great opportunity because our products are interesting. They've got a great story to tell. And finally, in terms of the opportunities, I think business going forward will value sustainable business models. And I think, again, in Wales, we're good at that. I think there's an amazing background, whether it's future generations, whatever it is, we're very good at that. I think in terms of challenges, Pete, finances are critically important. And we acknowledge that in that plan that we have, the 11-point plan, financial affordability is critical. And we need to make sure that we support businesses through that. So final comment on that is we have a plan, 11-point plan. Absolutely, a plan is worthless unless we deliver it. So we actually have a delivery plan. And ultimately, it's all about support we can provide to deliver that. Thanks, Pete.
Terrific, Andy. That's excellent. I mean, David, taking the word plan, you talked your plan for recovery that you've just published this week. Just be interested to get a sense of how that come together with yourselves and Scotland Food and Drink, and again, what the aspirations are within that and the opportunities and challenges.
Yeah, so in Scotland, we have a great advantage. We have had for over a decade a partnership between the private and public sector called Scotland Food and Drink. We were founding members of that partnership and are an enthusiastic part of that. And that has a track record of delivering industry success, supporting the industry with a range of initiatives. And we do that in partnership with the Scottish Government, Scottish Enterprise and Scottish Development International, amongst many others. Obviously, you know, when COVID hit, we wanted to make sure that we had a credible plan for the industry that develops our long-term Ambition 2030 plan, which is to double the size of the industry by 2030 in Scotland, and also a plan that dealt as much as possible with the vagaries of Brexit. And we worked collaboratively with a whole range of trade associations at Scottish Government and others to get to the point where last week the First Minister was able to launch it with a first slug of money of £5 million, and that will be matched by £3 million worth of industry money over the next 3 years. And it's got two key parts, two key focuses. The first is stimulating demand in key markets, and then the second is supporting businesses to capitalise on that demand. And we segment the markets like this. So we have a local market in Scotland, 5 million consumers, very, very interested in the provenance of their food, very interested in the stories behind their food, and wanting, especially after the lockdown, to support local businesses and to eat more locally. Then we have, obviously, the UK market, which is of critical importance to Scottish food and drink producers. 80% of what we produce in Scotland goes to the rest of the UK roundabout. So capitalising on that by supporting the Scottish brand and its products in the UK and in particular around the southeast are really important. And then in terms of the international outreach, we already have through Scottish Development International 15 food and drink specialists around the world. And what we are doing is enhancing their ability to actually not just find markets, they're incredibly good at finding markets and opportunities. It's making sure that companies are supported to meet those markets when the opportunities do come to them, and there's a whole range of actions around that.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting because in a previous life, and I'll come on to Andy to pick up on that point, we were a beneficiary of the business I was working in of a huge enough amount of support, basically going to the Chicago PLMA with the Welsh government, took us there to help us grow our brand and grow our business. And it's one thing I noticed that there was a call for UK export support. And obviously, I think both Scotland and Wales, Andy, can shout to considerable successes of their own. And I'm just wondering how those, the call for a UK export support and the success of Wales and Scotland, how that could dovetail. I suppose I'll pass that one to you first, Andy, if that's okay.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. I think that's a really important point. We all know that we need to export more, and I think the world market will ask for that. I think the only challenge we've got on that, Pete, is we don't know what the nature of some of the trade deals are. I think we all know that some of the trade deals that have been announced, for example, Canada, ultimately it's a rollover deal, and I'm pleased and well done to everybody for doing that. But I believe that that's going to be renegotiated at some point next year. So the definition of that export market, I think it's important going forward. I think we need to understand what the strategy is, firstly, for the UK to access these different international markets. You know, we talk about CPTPP, we talk about Gulf regions, we talk about China and the US. I think business needs to understand that. In terms of your specific question about UK body, if you like, I think it's absolutely critical. You know, can we do better working between devolved nations? Absolutely, yes. Is it a criticism of government? No, because it's actually quite hard. But I think business needs to take the lead in that. I think that's the critical thing. Business has to take the lead in driving those export markets, and government needs to, which is, you know, it's showing signs of doing that, is to listen what business is asking for, Pete. The only challenge we have is that Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland are doing a lot of good work. I think there was a notable absence of an English food and drink board, and I think that's holding us back in some respects.
Fascinating. And David, from a Scottish perspective, you opened up this conversation just in picking that up in terms of fitting in with the UK thoughts. What are your thoughts?
So, you know, the story that we've got is one of having to do it ourselves. So the I'll probably be a bit more controversial than Andy in this, but it's the story of having to do it ourselves. So, you know, when all this picked up 12 years ago now, when I was in government, looked at what had happened, and the government had disbanded an organisation called Food from Britain, which gave a lot of export support to people. So we had to pick up the pieces of that and say, well, what's right for Scotland? And we did, and we built something that is you know, successful and looked at by other countries, including our Celtic cousins, as something to emulate in some ways. And so from our perspective, we built this, and around that, we've built an idea of Scotland. We've built a brand around Scottish food and drink, and that's precious. You know, that's worth money in particular markets. And when we come to you know, UK government marketing approaches, very much they ignore the different national and subnational brands that one could have by trying to talk too much about the UK. And that doesn't play when you've tried to create your own brand for Scotland, for Wales, for Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. So what we need in this you know, proposed food sector council is a very simple bit of governance, which means that no one part of the UK has predominance, and that there is so that businesses across the UK can get the best of both worlds. So they can get the might of the UK government, they can use the Union Jack where that's appropriate and works in that market, but in other markets where there's more cachet for Scottish or Welsh or Northern Irish, then, you know, the freedom to use that in a way that makes sense for business, because it has to be commercially led. And I think just to finish on that, in Scotland, the resources which are managed by Scottish Development International are actually deployed in the markets and are judged on their success by a panel of industry representatives. So it's actually industry that's driving where they are and judging whether they're successful or not.
Okay, interesting. Thank you, David. We've talked quite a lot there about support and support for business, support for industry. I mean, one of the things, just to come back to you, Andy, is obviously a lot of this stuff is is trying to help our sector, is trying to drive growth, is trying to help the businesses. I suppose the sort of simpler question is, if you're a business sitting there listening to this, how would you suggest they reach out and engage and find out what is an offer and what could work for them?
Okay, no, great question. Thanks, Pete. So I mentioned earlier on about the 11-point action plan that we've come up with. And I mentioned earlier on that that plan is worthless unless we do something. So what the Welsh Government have actually commissioned some work is actually to take businesses through what I call, my language, a self-diagnosis tool. And effectively, it takes you through each of the areas of the 11-point plan to help individual businesses recognise which are the most important for their business, and then to provide a link to the most efficient and effective resource available, support available to help you deliver that. So as I say, what we want to do is to link the plan to almost like the self-diagnosis for a business, and then connect that to support. And I believe that was actually launched earlier on this week, so that should be online. If not, we can circulate it, Pete. But yeah, I think absolutely, that's really important, that process.
Okay, terrific. I mean, one other thing that I've come across and that's also part of that whole network, Andy, is the cluster network that's in Wales. You know, that, I think that's something that's very, very important and something that could people could reach out to.
Yeah, definitely.
So, David, you touched on it slightly earlier. So to go back then, in terms of if you're in Scotland, you're a business in Scotland, you're thinking, where do I start to look? What doors would you suggest, or how do you open the right doors?
I think what you both meant to say was join the Food and Drink Federation and we'll make sure you're right. But there's the truth in that. You know, there's a whole range of trade associations that are part of the partnership who are keyed into this, whether that's ourselves, Scottish Bakers, the meat wholesalers, etc. So make sure that you're making use of the trade associations that you're part of. Work with, you know, if you're working with Scottish Enterprise or one of the other enterprise agencies in Scotland, then, you know, they are keyed into this as well. And I think the last thing is, you know, when we're developing what are a whole range of potential projects, then your commercial partners and the project teams will be reaching out to businesses. So, for example, we work on supplier development with supermarkets. Quite often that's an agreement between the Scotland Food and Drink Partnership and the supermarket. Who does the supermarket want to see being developed to potentially supply them? Who does Scotland Food and Drink think are likely candidates? So, you know, we will be reaching out as well. But the easiest way to do that, I think, is to join the Food and Drink Federation.
Fair enough. I can't disagree with that as well. Moving on to a personal topic of mine that I've got a great passion about is about automation and production efficiency. Now, one of the things we've heard the term is in terms of business resilience. That's a term that's really come to the fore over recent months. And I suppose one, in terms of opportunities for businesses or to embrace automation in our sector, what do you see? As we'll come to you first, Andy, from a Welsh perspective. What do you see in Wales as opportunities in that area?
Sure. So I think I'd say, of course, it's definitely an opportunity. I would just like to sort of break it down a little bit between production innovation, efficiency, and product innovation. And I think we shouldn't forget, I know you've asked the question about production, but I think product innovation is critical to our success in Wales. And that obviously links to the backstory and sustainability that I mentioned earlier on. But in terms of production innovation, I think we should learn from a number of organisations where there's best practice. I think there's huge innovation in the Welsh food and drink sector, but we should also learn from others. So I don't really know the work that Toyota do down, I think, based on Portalboy, South Wales. And it is absolutely fascinating because it is part of their DNA to actually have a relentless pursuit in terms of efficiency. Efficiency leads to innovation, and they spread that word out to business. And it's almost contagious, the level of discussion when you have with them. So I think it's easy for me to just say production, innovation, yes, of course, it's important. But I think the challenge is the how. And I know that, Pete, you're involved in the work of AMRC, and you may want to make comment about that later on. Final comment I would have is it's not just about individual businesses. It's about ways of working across the whole sector. And I think we must also lift our eyes up to making that innovation across supply chains, not just within individual businesses. And I think that's where most of our success will lie. It's certainly in Wales, in my view.
Thanks, Andy. I'll just add two personal interests there. One, I'm ex-Toyota, so I fully understand what you mean about Toyota. And B, absolutely, one of the works that the Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre in Cymru is trying to do is trying to bring businesses together with common challenges, but also fix individual challenges as well. So it's looking at it from both perspectives. So hopefully that's what you'd be looking for. David, over to you. You define innovation as any way you wish. What would you like to say?
I define it very widely, but you know, the issues in Scotland are the same, you know, in general as the issues that Andy has set out. So in terms of product and, in fact, company innovation, you know, we've seen a massive growth in Scotland over the past 15 years of new business sectors. You know, the craft beer sector, the craft gin sector are massive in Scotland. They didn't exist 15 years ago, not even 10 years ago, I don't think. So there's been a massive number of, you know, sectoral and company innovations. The product innovation is very much about, you know, what are the stories we can tell, and we can tell that from our most traditional products to you know, brand new products that are being made in artisanal ways or so on. When you're talking about you know, production innovation, it gets harder, and it gets harder for a couple of reasons. The first reason is the money. So the amount of uncertainty that we've had in Scotland since before 2014, you know, in the UK since the Brexit vote, and possibly in Scotland again with, you know, the potential of another independence referendum, means that businesses are often a little concerned about spending money with a long payback as compared to someone, because they're not really sure about the return on investment. And the Scottish Government have been pretty good. There's a food processing manufacturing grant which comes and goes, and that's supported an enormous amount of businesses to enhance their production. And we need to see that going forward. We don't know the future of that post-Brexit because it was partly European money. And that's the kind of thing, that kind of funding support that can get businesses over the hump to support their efficiency. And actually, the food and drink sector in Scotland, in particular the food sector, you know, whiskey is enormously efficient. But the food sector has a long way to go in order to get more production efficient and to, you know, get a better gross value added and return on investment. So one of the things the Scottish Government has done, like the MRC, has created a National Manufacturing Institute for Scotland. It's a wee bit behind what's happening in Wales and in other parts of the UK, but they're very keen to engage in the food industry. And again, FDF are reaching out to them to make sure that what they provide is best for the food industry.
Okay, that's terrific. Thank you. Well, you touched on it where you mentioned the B word, but there's really no getting away from the imminent end of the EU transition. So I suppose, just given that we're talking about recovery, Andy, if you were to, there's so many things and there's so many uncertainties, but what would be your concerns for a sector in Wales? And if you had to suggest three things for businesses to do between now and the end of EU transition, what would they be?
Okay, I thought you might be bringing up the B word, so I have prepared some thoughts on that. Obviously, we all know that the outcome is not clear. We all know that. The biggest thing for me is, because Wales is very SME orientated, obviously I'm very mindful of that, but particularly at the moment, because I think SMEs have been disproportionately affected by coronavirus. In fact, many have lost people, so there are less people to be able to manage our way through in terms of the paperwork implications. But obviously from a financial position, it's quite critical. I think the three things that I would say in response to your question, Pete, are firstly, to remember that it's about importing and exporting. I hear a lot of discussion about the export paperwork, but don't forget, and I don't mean to teach grandmas like eggs, but that it's an import issue. And in my view, the British government have slightly sort of given people a curveball, because they said, quote, we will just wave goods through post 1st of January. And of course, that isn't quite true, because actually, whilst they will be waved through when they get to a British port, we still as importers have to do the paperwork that we need to get it into the exporting port, Zeebrugge, Rotterdam. So I talking to people, I often hear that importing has been left out. I think the second thing is processing skills. So it's about paperwork processes. Talking to people, I think generally has been a massive under preparation for the skills. I think certainly the business, bigger businesses are probably as well prepared as they can be, but I'm talking about all the paperwork you need to fill out. You know, it's a massive undertaking. And I would just say, look, you need to get your paperwork to a stage where it's auditable. And don't forget, one thing that Michael Gove said last week was 80% of the paperwork that we need to do is common to either outcome. And I think that's really important that we just need to remember that. Paperwork's critical. And the third thing, and it's not a throwaway, is talk. I absolutely passionately believe that, and this is where the plug for FDF comes, you have to engage with like-minded organisations. You know, I don't work for FDF, you two do, but I will still say this, that actually FDF is probably the single best organisation to engage with during Brexit and indeed coronavirus, and it's a wealth of information. So I will certainly support what you've been saying about membership, but talk to other people. Pete, you talked about clusters. Welsh Government are incredibly supportive, and you've got a food and drink board. So I would say that's important, communication. Thanks, Pete.
Thanks, Andy. So the same question over to David.
Where do we start? Again, as Andy said, you know, a lot of it is about talking, trying to understand what's going on and preparing as best you can. You know, we've been urging businesses for the whole of this year to prepare as best you can for either outcome. And it's been, difficult to do that when the answers from government have only just started now to come in, and some will still not come in yet because they're waiting on the trade deal. So it's difficult to do that credibly, but that's certainly what we have been doing. Prepare for as much as you can. I think there are kind of three watchwords, I think. The first one is around logistics. So the import-export issue that Andy said, I think that's where the FDF feels that the crunch point is going to be in the end of December, start of January period. For goodness sake, make sure you've got stuff over the border. If you can, get stuff over the border in the right time, because that'll save you probably several paying phone calls. So that's in the short term, it's around long logistics. I think in the medium term, it's how do the markets react? If there are tariffs, if there are additional costs or delays, you might not be able to sell in the market that you're currently used to selling to in Europe. Or you might not be able to get the things that you want, you know, whether that's packaging or ingredients, in at the same cost, in the same ease. So all of that means in the medium term, there's bound to be some kind of market shift to different suppliers and different customers. And be prepared for that. Be trying to understand that volatility and don't just rely on what you've already been used to. And I think in the long term, we've got, it's actually the legislation that's going to be interesting, I think. So we've got two different vectors of legislation. So the first is divergence with the European Union. So inevitably, at some point, we will choose not to do something the European Union does, or do it more slowly, or otherwise, we will choose to do something that the European Union doesn't want to do. And that's inevitable, and it will increase over time. So the divergence of legislation with the EU is going to be a long-term issue. The second part of legislation is, and we touched on this in the session with Neris, is the divergence of legislation within the UK. So previously, you had the European framework that meant everyone worked within a clear set of rules. There was differentiation in different parts of the UK, but it was within a framework. That framework within the UK hasn't been worked out and is deeply controversial. We may face a future where we have four different pieces of legislation within the UK about one thing, and it's critical. It might be labelling, for example. So all of that means that actually thinking about regulation, thinking about influencing where that goes, being involved in these decisions becomes even more critical for food businesses.
So first of all, I'd like to thank Neris, Andy and David for the most interesting session.
FDF Awards, one of the most prestigious nights in the food and drink calendar, is online 3rd of February. For details of this and other FDF events, including our online convention, visit our website, fdf.org.uk. FDF, passionate about food and drink.
Yep.
Let's go for it. Welcome back to FDF's final tranche in our section, Scotland and Wales Key Focus Areas. Can I remind you, we are actively encourage you to ask questions in the question tab, so by all means, please put something in the chat box. When you consider the scale of the opportunities and challenges that are faced by our sector, we put them into four sections at the moment: COVID recovery, EU exit, tackling obesity, and the green recovery. For this session, we would like to discuss the latter two and how we see them developing in Scotland and Wales. And to do this, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleagues Kat Hay from Scotland and Julie Byers. How are we doing, guys? Are we okay?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Terrific. So I'm looking to tackling obesity first. Both governments, Welsh and Scottish governments, have demonstrated they've got powers in setting health policy. But when it comes to food and drink, asking you, Kat, first, what specific areas of policy does the Scottish government have?
Thanks, Pete, and good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for having me along. I really wanted to pick up on something specific David mentioned in the previous session. I mean, I could talk diet and health policy all afternoon, but I think we're rather pushed for time, so I'll stick with this. But in 2018, the Scottish Government published their Healthier Futures document, which is effectively Scotland's obesity strategy. And within that, there was a number of actions for Scottish Government and other partners to do. But one of the areas that was causing concern for the food and drink industry is the plans to introduce a bill that will restrict the promotion and marketing of so-called discretionary foods. Now, I'm going to head off one of the questions that I know is going to zoom into the box in a second, which, what on earth is a discretionary food? Well, we're kind of looking at narrower range of categories than counterparts in England. The Scottish Government has sweet and savoury snacks, confectionery, cakes, biscuits and soft drinks. Snacking foods, what they call impulse purchases within their sites, but they haven't really nailed down in exactly which products would and would not be in scope. But they're not looking at something that would constitute your main meal, so, you know, a pizza or a haggis, or ingredients that would go into those meals, so not a block of cheese, for example. In Scotland, the Scottish Government consulted on this last year and they looked at a very broad range of mechanisms that could be introduced to kind of restrict those promotions. As David said, the bill was due to be introduced this year, but due to hopefully the lobbying and influence from the Food and Drink Federation and also the impact of COVID, particularly on the hospitality and food sectors, that won't now be introduced until after the parliamentary elections. We expect the bill to come back very soon after the new parliament's formed. I would imagine we'll hear something about it in autumn 2021. Although, because of the parliamentary process, these two things do take time, so we probably won't see changes on shop shelves till maybe 23, 24, something like that. David also mentioned that there is broad cross-party support for the bill, so I think it's fair to say that it's something that will definitely come in Scotland. It is a primary piece of legislation, and what that means really is it's quite wide-ranging, and it's to allow legislation on a number of areas, not just the promotion and restricting promotion and marketing of these foods, but also the Scottish Government wants primary legislation that would allow them then to act on, say, a ban on energy drinks to under 16, or perhaps introducing mandatory calorie labelling on menus. Why is it concerning? Well, again, David mentioned, we know it will affect the smaller Scottish businesses who are always fighting for that brand recognition and very precious shelf space on the shops. And we also don't think it will work. So perhaps I'll come back to this later, but we think there's a much better approach, which is to encourage the industry to reformulate their products. And we've been working with the Scottish Government on that. As I say, I'll maybe come back to that slightly later on.
Okay, that's grand. That's grand. Thanks so much. So, Julie, in terms of your view of the obesity agenda in Wales, where's the sort of Welsh Government policy at the moment?
So it's quite an interesting space at the moment because Scotland, England and Wales kind of all at the same time are trying to do take action to tackle obesity, and it's kind of shifted from childhood obesity to just obesity generally. In Wales, they I think they were a little bit behind on publishing obesity strategies, but they did they consulted on a draft strategy called Healthy Weight, Healthy Wells, probably early last year, and they've since published the final strategy probably about a year ago. So, but we haven't really seen much since, but it's very similar to what we've heard from Kat about measures in Scotland, maybe not going as far as how wide-ranging they are, but what's really central to all the obesity strategies across the UK is the restrictions of the promotion of unhealthy foods and of the location of those products. I think there's a couple of ones in the Healthy Weight, Healthy Well strategy that aren't in other, well, that I think there may be similarities with Scotland, where there's about limits on upselling foods that are high in fat, salt and sugar, such as free refills, for instance. But there's a lot about more kind of taking a holistic approach. So looking at the healthy environments setting is only one part of the whole obesity strategy in Wales. It looks at healthy people, about promoting physical activity, and actually in education settings as well, about providing providing nutritional information, things like that too. I'd also just say it's with no one seems to really be taking the lead, because usually when there's kind of these types of policies, you might have Scotland and Wales being like the test beds to see if it works. But it kind of seems like it's all a little bit of a race to see whoever gets there first. But I think Wales is a little bit still yet to consult on such measures, whereas both England and Scotland are both ahead on there.
Okay, you've timed that perfectly, because we just had a question from Alistair Williams. Thank you, Alistair. And I'll pass it to Kat to give you a bit of thinking time, Julie. It says, do you think governments focusing on unhealthy eating rather than the food is likely to be more successful?
It's a very, very good question, and there's a lot of debate around this. I mean, I think everyone would welcome, as Julie said, a more holistic conversation about not just diet, but about lifestyle. There's a lot of other factors at play apart from just, you know, sometimes I feel that looking at just calories or macronutrients is just too simplistic. So to have a more holistic conversation and to look at the other factors that can drive obesity as well, around, you know, poverty, around mental well-being and other things as well.
Okay. Julie, your thoughts on that one?
I'd say there's kind of has been a focus on tackling unhealthy food, maybe because it's government sees it as an easier thing to try and tackle rather than actually where the hard work could be, and the more effective way to do it, like Kat was saying, is about taking that holistic approach, trying to about education and trying to change consumer behaviours in a different way is a little bit more challenging, so they're trying to do it that way possibly.
Okay, just to explore one point that Kat made then on the reformulation, Kat. You said you were going to say something next, so let's get to next and share your thoughts on reformulation. What is the view from the industry, if you like, on that topic?
Well, we see reformulation as very much a positive thing that industry can do to help consumers make the easier, healthier choices. And we are delighted in Scotland. We worked closely with the Scottish Government's Diet and Healthy Weight team when they were developing their Healthier Futures document. And as I say, there are some elements of that that industry finds a little bit challenging. However, one of the things they did agree to was to fund the FDF to pilot a number of approaches, working with small Scottish businesses, looking at how they can make food healthier in Scotland. Now, that could be reducing fat, sugar or salt, but also increasing fibre in fruit and veg. And it's not just the food and drink manufacturers that this programme looks at. It could be anyone from your high street butcher making sausage rolls. It could be a small cafe or a restaurant or anyone in Scotland who's involved in making food. The programme's had some really good successes so far, and we're hoping to expand that beyond a pilot and working with the government closely to see what would that look like. Sit within COVID recovery as well. How can we support the sector to build back healthier? I think is the key point there.
Okay. Julie, would you have any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I think the reformulation programme in Scotland is a really great piece of work, and it'd be great to see it mirrored elsewhere from the government in Westminster and also in the Welsh Government.
Okay, terrific. So we said we'd talk about obesity, and we also said we'd talk about the green recovery. Obviously, the term itself, green recovery, is a hugely expansive term. I suppose my question is, and again, I'll come to you first, Kat, in terms of how is that interpreted in Scotland, and what are the areas that you would see would create some significant opportunities or challenges for our sector out of that?
Well, I think you're right, Pete. Hugely expansive is absolutely the right phrase to use. A focus on green recovery seems to be top of everyone's agenda. My background is actually a station called Zero Waste Scotland before FDF Scotland. So I'm well versed in the long debate about sustainability. And I was working previously with food and drink manufacturers looking at how they could improve their sustainability. But I think the debate's moved on from just maybe focusing on things like energy, water and waste. That's still important, but it's much broader than it was. So when we talk about a focus on green recovery, it certainly creates great opportunities for Scottish food to be synonymous with a clean natural environment and sustainable production methods for food and drink producers. But it does grow arms and legs. So we're moving into much more complex debates and opportunities, healthy sustainable diets, perhaps the fair work agenda and skills for the future as well. We have seen the Scottish Government set up, there was the Economic Recovery Group, which published a very long report in late summer, and also reports from various Scottish parliamentary committees on what exactly a green recovery means. It's all very high level, it's all very well intentioned, but I've heard many kind of colleagues and stakeholders describing it as mother's apple pie. You're not going to fundamentally disagree with any of the principles that these organisations and groups are coming out with. In terms of making sure that as a nation we're much more environmentally sustainable. But it's a bit of a challenge. We need to understand what the new normal really is to allow the ambitious food businesses in Scotland to make great investment decisions that increase sustainability. I get calls all the time from our Scottish members saying, you know, Kat, how can I make my business or my product more environmentally sustainable? What's the best to do? I've heard challenges from businesses over the years about changing packaging. You know, there's been so much in the media over the last few years about the impact of plastics on our environment. And yes, plastics are, you know, there are issues with plastics, but also plastics are lightweight and they're recyclable. So if you're a business and you're thinking, do I get rid of my plastic and replace it with a cardboard box? Perhaps that increases emissions because you can't fit as many products on a pallet. So how do you weigh things up? How do you balance these things? It's really, really tricky for businesses to navigate. And it's really important that they work with external organisations like Zero Waste Scotland and others in Scotland to look at their own sustainability and get that expert support. I want to quickly touch on the fact that Scotland's net zero target is 5 years ahead of England's. And how we achieve this is going to be set out in the climate change plan, or the latest version of Scotland's climate change plan, which I think is due for publication imminently, possibly as soon as next week. And I'm hoping that within that there'll be clearer policies that will allow food businesses to be able to focus on where best using that sustainability approach.
That's fascinating.
I'll pause there for Wales, I think.
Okay, I'll give you some thinking time because I've just written down COP26 in Glasgow. So I'll give you some thinking time and I'll come back to you. Julie, in terms of Wales, what's your thought process on the whole environmental green recovery debate in Wales?
Yeah, I was just going to echo comments that Kat just made about how wide-ranging green recovery is. I think it means different things to different people and to different governments. Kind of top of the agenda for the Welsh Government at the moment is obviously their environmental agenda, and they just consulted earlier this year about their Beyond Recycling agenda and moving to a more circular economy, and they've since published that and trying to look at how they'll go about achieving it. And I think essentially, this is a really big, it's a priority for the Welsh Government because they're already one of the world leaders in recycling rates, and they want to be number one. Essentially, they're not just happy with being number one out of the UK; they want to be number one in the world. So they're looking at ways to be able to achieve that. And moving to a circular economy kind of reduces the waste, not just about recycling it. And when we've been speaking to the Welsh government, it's very much of, okay, if with businesses want to be more sustainable, how is the Welsh government going to be supporting them in doing so? It's going to require a lot of investment. And actually, how is that going to be delivered rather than just placing financial burdens on businesses? There's also an interesting interaction with England at the moment as well, because obviously we have the Environment Bill going through Parliament, where Wales has signed up to a couple of those measures. So we've got the reforms to extended producer responsibility, which is UK-wide, and there's also the introduction of the deposit return scheme, which Scotland is way ahead of everyone else. They'll introduce that before, because we're still in the consultation stage, but England, Wales and Northern Ireland have all signed up to essentially trying to get a coherent scheme. But Wales will be quite precious about making sure that that does not impact its recycling rates. So there could be some way of them maybe wanting to kind of tweak slightly and trying to maintain that.
Okay, fascinating. Okay, can I give you some thinking time? I hope you don't mind to come back to you then on this COP26. It was supposed to be whatever it was, November this year. Is it in the news? Is it on the agenda? Is it on the horizon? Or are people just battling with what we've got to battle with at the moment?
You know what? I think that's a really good way of summing up. I think, yes, it's definitely on the horizon. I would say it's on everyone's agenda. I think everybody wants to do something, including the Scottish Government, who will publish plans about announcements they'll make at COP26. I suppose, again, it comes back to that clear policy direction for the food and drink companies who are trying to navigate the other policy issues that have been touched on this afternoon, you know, COVID and Brexit being so forefront of the mind. This is there, but it's not front and central at the moment. I do think that perhaps a foreign nations approach to this would be really, really welcome. As Julie mentioned, we've seen Scotland implementing their own DRS deposit return scheme, which has caused challenges because of a GB supply chain. And we're going to see just how challenging that can get. The national energy grid, it doesn't stop at the Scottish border. So we need to think about a comprehensive energy strategy for at least a GB and how that all works together. And looking at decarbonising the grids. I mean, do we really need separate food waste reduction targets or separate deposit return schemes or separate recycling targets? The flip side of that is, as Julie said, perhaps happening faster, we'll see Scotland catch up with Wales in terms of our recycling credentials. And it certainly potentially provides a great opportunity to develop Scottish circular economy, and as I said earlier, great opportunities for the Scottish food businesses to really show off those green credentials to the ever more environmentally conscious shopper.
Okay, fascinating. I suppose, I don't even know, is COP26 something that's very much a Scottish activity, or are other businesses in other parts of the country engaging in that? How do you feel that's working? I asked you that, Julie, just to see what you've seen in that regard.
Yeah, I would say COP26, I don't know if everyone's kind of seen kind of when COP26 was meant to be happening. This November, you saw a lot of organisations set out their roadmaps to kind of reducing emissions, becoming net zero. That's very much because everyone was preparing for it to coincide with that date. And obviously now we have it for next year. So I suppose now it's all about those organisations and trade associations to kind of continue that work, but also put it in practice, really. I just wanted to echo something that Kat was saying about coherent strategies, because I think as much as I think there is an opportunity for devolved governments, and particularly Wales, like we've seen with, they've been able to go off with really increasing their recycling rate, and they've been doing that through like statutory local authority targets for recycling collections. So it's almost where they can try and do better with their devolved powers, but whilst not trying to impact businesses by doing something that is completely separate completely separate. So businesses have to comply with something completely different in four different countries.
Okay, interesting. It's a good way to finish. So just to finish the session, I'm going to ask Neris and David to join us again. If you guys could get yourself back on the screen. Hello, hello, Neris. I see if David's there. Oh, there he is. Excellent. So I'm just going to go in order. It's the old classic question. If you had one thing that you wanted the people that have attended this webinar to pick up or to remember, I'll start with you, Neris, if that's okay. What would be the one highlight that you would want to share at this session?
I guess in terms of for a UK-wide audience, is to reinforce the fact that we're not served by our media very well here in Wales. It doesn't always reflect the political and the policy reality outside of England. So always kind of look behind those headlines in terms of what's actually applicable here in Wales. And we have got our own, obviously, Senedd and powers and Welsh Government. And looking towards the election, a great opportunity to influence the political parties as we head towards the new government post-May, and urge people to get behind FDF in terms of a great umbrella organisation that's championing the cause of food and drink manufacturing across Wales on your behalf.
Thank you. And Kate, Kat, I'll invite you back, and David, I'll invite you to say a few words.
The one thing, I suppose, can I have two? Which is just in terms of government support for a couple of programmes that FDF are providing in Scotland, the Reformulation for Health one, which I've touched on, but also our Future in Food programme, which is looking at making sure that we have the right recruits for the future as well in terms of our engineers, our food technologies and things like that. So if I had a government pocket, that's the one I'd be asking for.
Okay, I'll come to David next, if that's okay.
Thanks, Pete. I think the main thing I'd like to say around the work that we do in Scotland and Wales is that it is just as complex and it covers just as many policy areas as the work that's been done with the UK government. It just so happens that we have smaller and more agile teams that rely on our experts in London, but really get to the nub of the issue in Scotland and in Wales. So it's, you know, the FDF does have that capability. We are here working for members. But remember that everything that the Scottish Government does has a mirror in London and a mirror in Cardiff as well. So there's a lot going on, and it's probably busier than it's ever been in my 5 years here.
Well, I'm glad I joined at this time then. So Julie, over to you.
Yeah, going last. Hopefully I'm not touching on the points already made. But yeah, just going off what David was just saying about how kind of with, even though it's smaller parliaments in Wales and Scotland, there's still just as many policies and policy decisions being made. And when we think about political engagement and everything, sometimes we just think about Westminster, about engaging with MPs, but actually it's just as important to engage with members of the Scottish Parliament and also members of the Senedd, especially in the run-up to the elections. And both FDF Cymru and FDF Scotland will be doing a lot of work trying to talk to candidates ahead of then too.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. And actually, thank you to all of you for your contributions today. I really, really appreciate it. Very interesting stuff. We've got a lot to do. So obviously now, like everyone else, we have to go and crack on.
And finally, it just remains for me to say thank you. Thank you to Clark Energy and EIT, our generous sponsors. Thank you to all our presenters and all those who provided content for this event. And most of all, to you. We couldn't do this without you. I know it's been different, but it's been a big success. I look forward to welcoming you to FDF events in person in the future. Thanks again and goodbye.
FDF Awards, one of the most prestigious nights in the food and drink calendar, is online 3rd of February. For details of this and other FDF events, including our online convention, visit our website, fdf.org.uk.